Okay, so thanks for the invitation. So, I mean, I'm not the world expert on string loop amplitudes, but I mean, I'll say some things about it, and you can ask questions. So, I guess the first question to ask is, you know, why we're interested in string amplitudes. So of course, string amplitudes came before string theory. So, in some sense, in the original formulation of string theory, amplitudes were used in some sense to define what we meant by string theory. And these, of course, are always perturbative amplitudes. I won't have anything to say about non-perturbative contributions to scattering amplitude. So now, of course, we know much more about string theory. And we know not just about perturbative amplitudes, but other aspects of string theory. But still, perturbative amplitudes are a large ingredient in string theory. And we learn a lot about string theory, even non-perturbative aspects of string theory, by studying perturbative amplitudes. So for example, there are duality symmetries in string theory. Which, of course, imply not only the non-perturbative structure in string theory, but imply a lot about the perturbative structure. And in fact, a lot of the string-motivated reasons for studying perturbative amplitudes at the moment are to test these duality symmetries. So there are all these duality symmetries. Some of them are related to ADS-CFT. Some are related to, for example, SL2Z invariants, so strong, weak type 2B. So, of course, if you showed that the perturbative amplitudes were inconsistent with the SL2Z, that would, of course, rule out the duality symmetry. Okay, of course, there's another reason to study these amplitudes, which is not for string theory applications, but for applications to just field theory. So, when Nima gave his talk yesterday, I mean, it's kind of like to say that everything new about field theory amplitudes was started, you know, in the last 10 or 20 years is not really true. I mean, we've had this cycle between Feynman diagram techniques and other techniques for computing amplitudes. And of course, many ingredients from these perturbative amplitudes were understood in string theory before they were understood using twister techniques or other techniques, et cetera. So just to give some ingredients of these amplitudes, which are essentially trivial to understand in string theory. So for example, this open to closed relation between super-Yang-Mills and supergravity. It's very easy to see in string theory. There are other properties of these field theory amplitudes that are essentially almost definitions in string theory. So for example, the idea that you strip off the color factors and that gives you a simpler definition of the amplitudes is, of course, almost a definition in string theory. You don't have to, whereas in field theory, it's some new technique that was developed. But of course, in string theory, it's already there. There are other features from the string theory point of view that essentially are not present in the Feynman diagram technique. So for example, string theory on shell external states, you can either view it as a liability that we don't really know how to go off shell in string theory, or you can see it as a positive feature that essentially the nice features of field theory amplitudes when states are on shell are necessary in string theory. So somehow it makes it easier to get to the nice properties of the amplitudes. You can't even ask questions about the ugly features. Okay, so there's one other property that I want to say something about, so for example, OPEs in string theory. Are of course closely related to three-point amplitude. So some of the recent work in field theory amplitudes suggests that really contact terms are something to be avoided if possible, so four-point contact terms, and essentially everything can be done just by knowing the three-point amplitude. So, of course, in string theory, that's automatically true, because once we know these OPEs, we essentially can read off the three-point amplitudes and build up the whole structure of the scattering. So interrupt me if you have any comments or I'm saying something stupid or whatever. Okay, so these are some nice features. These are, of course, all in bosonic string theory. I don't have to say anything about superstring to get to these nice features of scattering amplitude. So, well, of course, there are some not so nice features of string theory, which is that it likes to be in dimensions higher than 4. So, of course, bosonic string theory is d equals 26. And in that theory, there's another nice, not so nice feature that you have a tachyon, which is just another way to say that the ground state is not massless. So the massless states are excited states. Where the tachyon is the ground state. So that means when you want to take the field theory limit of string amplitudes, you can't just naively take alpha prime go to 0. You can't just, because the ground state, you have to somehow get rid of this tachyon ground state. So that makes it slightly unnatural, at least for bosonic string theory, to get to these field theory amplitudes. But of course, superstring, where d equals 10, doesn't have this problem. So you start with the massless ground state. And of course, the other feature of superstring theory in d equals 10 is that you have maximal supersymmetry. So if you reduce, dimensionally reduce to d equals 4, you have the maximum 16 for open strings and 32 for closed strings. Now, maximal supersymmetry is another ingredient that I didn't mention here. But maximal supersymmetry, independently of string theory, also fixes you essentially to have on-shell external states. So in some sense, these two features match nicely between string theory and spacetime supersymmetry. And the reason is because we don't yet know a formulation of maximal supersymmetry in which the states, or you can write an action, for example, in which the supersymmetry is manifest. So we don't really know how to go off shell in a maximally supersymmetric way. Now again, you can either treat that as a bad feature or as a good feature. It's a bad feature in the sense that, well, maybe you want to describe off-shell scattering amplitudes. But as we've heard many times already, is that somehow the nice features of scattering amplitudes come out when you force the external states to be on-shell. So this is actually going to be a good feature when we compute scattering amplitudes, as we'll see soon. OK, so the usual formulation of the superstring in 10 dimensions is using RNS. So bosonic string, so some of the audience don't know, I assume, don't know string theory. Is that a valid assumption? So let me say a little bit about bosonic string. So the fundamental variables you have are xm, m is 0 to 25. And then you put in some ghosts, which come from gauge fixing some Wilczek symmetries. I'm not going to go into too much detail. In the superstring, there are different versions. There's something called RNS, in which, so these are ghosts, Wilczek ghosts, and these are matter field. In the RNS formulation, we have XM. So we have XM and psi M. So these are fermionic anti-commuting and commuting variables. But they're both space-time vectors. Okay, so now m is 0 to 9. And the ghosts, you have a BC, but you also have a set of bosonic ghosts. So the symmetries are slightly different. This turns out to have, for each boson, you have a fermion of the same Lorentz transformation properties. So it turns out to have something called Wilczek supersymmetry. But it turns out in this formalism, these nice features turn out to be not manifest. So So for example, although the physical ground state turns out to be massless, it turns out that there is, before doing a certain projection, there is a tachyonic ground state in this. And it has to be projected out. Furthermore, supersymmetry is not manifest. It's clear that it's not because you have bosonic and fermionic variables with the same Lorentz transformation properties, where you would expect if you had space-time supersymmetry manifest, this would have been a space-time spin. So supersymmetry is not manifest. Now, when you compute scattering amplitudes, it turns out that even if you have external bosons, so let's say you're computing a purely bosonic, let's say a four-point amplitude, of course, the internal states can either be bosons or fermions. So you could have amplitudes where these are bosons, or you could have amplitudes where they're fermions in the loop. In the INS formalism, the space-time fermions and bosons appear in a very different way. And in fact, it's very simple to describe space-time boson scattering, but space-time fermionic scattering is difficult. And in fact, if you want to compute even the one-loop amplitude, you have to sum together different diagrams. This diagram, for example, would be a fermion circulating, another would be a boson circulating. And the nice properties of the amplitude only come after summing these. So that's one additional feature of string theory amplitudes, which is nicer than field theory amplitudes, is essentially at each loop order, you just get one type of contribution. So the reason is because essentially a string, and if you compute, for example, four-point amplitude, you could have this type of contribution in a field theory. But in a string theory computation, essentially everything is solid lines. It's a surface here. So you can actually deform this into this type of amplitude. So another nice feature of string theory amplitudes over field theory amplitudes is that you don't have to consider various diagrams at each loop order and then sum them to get something which is gauge invariant and simple. So in some sense, string theory just gives you the answer in the form of a single type of diagram. Question? Okay. So for bosonic string theory, at each loop order, essentially there is just one diagram. But in RNS, because of this difficulty of describing bosons and fermions using the same description, you have to do a sum over spin string. So this is an undesirable feature of this RNS formalism. And essentially, it's related to the fact that space-time supersymmetry is not manifest. Okay, so about 20. So RNS is essentially 1973. And in the 80s, Green and Schwartz developed an alternative formalism for computing loop amplitudes, or the superstring, for describing the superstring, in which the fundamental variables were. X and theta instead of. So this is Green and Schwartz. And the open question, Green Schwartz, which is what's the ghost variable? So this is the matter sector. And you see now we're in 10 dimensions, of course. So M is 0 to 9, and alpha is 1 to 16. If you want to do type 2, you also have theta left and theta right. And they wrote down a worldsheet action, but it turned out only to be known how to quantize in light cone gauge. So they computed some amplitudes in light cone gauge, but light cone computations have other difficulties that I don't want to go into unless there's some questions. So essentially, they stopped at 4.1 loop. They didn't do any computations beyond 4.1 loop. Since then, so this was done in the essentially. Since then, there has been some work on green shorts in light cone gauge, but there hasn't been much advancement in the computation of scattering amplitude. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about in the rest is essentially, if you could either think of it as a quantization of green shorts, but there might be a better way to describe it that I will say something about on Thursday. So this formula has been called pure spinner formula. And the starting point, one way to get to the starting point is essentially by green shorts. You start with xm and theta alpha, and you add a ghost variable, which I'll use the letter lambda to denote. And the unusual feature of this ghost variable is that it satisfies a constraint. So normally, when you quantize using BRST method, then of course, for each classical constraint, if it's a bosonic classical constraint, you get a fermionic ghost. If it's a fermionic classical constraint, you get a bosonic ghost. It turns out there are both fermionic and bosonic constraints in green shorts. The bosonic constraints are, of course, related to the Wilczek reparameterization invariants, and the fermionic constraints are related to something called kappa symmetry. It might be natural to interpret this as a kind of ghost coming from gauge fixing kappa symmetry, but there are two strange features. So one strange feature is this ghost is constrained. So it satisfies the constraint lambda gamma m lambda equals 0. So Cartan called this a pure spinner. It means that lambda, instead of having 16 independent degrees of freedom, has only 11. Now, the other strange feature is that there's no bosonic, there's no fermionic ghosts. So somehow, the pure spinner has taken care of both the fermionic and bosonic symmetries of the green Schwarz act. OK, there's another interpretation I'll say something about on Thursday, which is that instead of thinking about x and theta as matter variables, and lambda alpha as a ghost variable, so that would be natural if you try to interpret it as coming from gauge fixing green Schwarz. I think that interpretation has not, well, as you'll see, it's very powerful in the sense that it allows you to compute loop amplitude. As understanding it from coming from gauge fixing, nobody has really given a nice picture of how this description comes directly out of green Schwarz. It turns out there's another description which might be more suitable, which I won't say anything more about today, but if you interpret x and lambda as coming from as matter variables, so not starting from green Schwarz, but starting from something which looks more like a bosonic string, and quantizing a constraint which is something like a twister-like constraint, so a twister-like constraint would be something of this type. Then that would generate a fermionic ghost. So instead of interpreting x and theta as matter and lambda as ghost, it might be more natural to interpret x and lambda as matter and theta as coming as from the ghost. That at least seems to give a more straightforward construction of the BRST operator I'll describe next. Okay, so the question of ghosts is related to the question of which states are positive norm and negative norm. But for example, XM, so it's a matter field, but it of course has both positive norm and negative norm because of the signature. The question of the norm for theta is even trickier because theta turns out to appear in first order form. So it appears in something like P. So this, essentially, all the all the thetas are half positive, half negative, or if you like, like. So the question of how to relate this to a light cone gauge formula. So of course, in light cone gauge, all the states are positive norm. But the question of how to extract the light cone green Schwarz out of this is not so straightforward. So it can be done. Essentially, you get all the light cone fermions come from here, and essentially this kills the extra light cone fermions, but it's not so straightforward. So, yeah? I will talk about this Thursday, but it's not straightforward. So as you'll see, this constraint is very different from p squared equals 0. So light cone is, of course, you solve p squared equals 0. This constraint is something else. It looks more like a twister-like constraint. So so the answers to these questions, I don't know the answer to, but it's clearly going to be a different structure. Okay, but what I'm going to try to convince you today is that at least this description of this x theta and lambda is the right description for computing string amplitudes. And then the question of where this description comes from, that I will postpone until Thursday. I mean, I won't claim to give you an answer on Thursday, but I'll at least try to say something useful. Okay. So what I want to convince you today is that this correctly describes string amplitude. And there's one feature that we can already say, which is just counting degrees of freedom. It has the same type of degrees of freedom as, for example, the RNS. So in RNS, of course, the computation which is easiest to do is the central charge computation. So you can ask if this theory has a conformal anomaly. It's easy to check that the central charge vanishes. But it's not manifestly vanishing in the sense that, for example, you have 10 x's and 10 psi's. They don't contribute with opposite sign because these are spin 1/2. And you get some non-trivial cancellation with the ghosts, which essentially fixes d equals 10. If you do this computation in the pure spinner formulation, you have the same number of x's. But now everything has the same conformal weight. So conformal weight is for RNS, I will call W the conjugate momentum to lambda. These are all conformal weight 0, 1. So every to count central charge, you just add up the number of bosons minus the fermions. And you find, of course, that there are 10 bosons. So C is just 10. There's 32 of these, minus 32. And because of this constraint, there are 22 of these. So at least the central charge cancellation works without any extra BC ghosts. There's another computation which is non-trivial, which is the level of the Lorentz algebra. So you have Lorentz generators, which in RNS, the spin contribution of the Lorentz generator is just psi m psi n. If I call this MMN, it has level 1. So that just means that if you compute the OPE of M with M, you get a double pole. Of course, you get a single pole too, but the level of the double pole is something which has to be computed. And if you do the same computation using these, you find that the theta in P gives a contribution to the level of plus 4, and the contribution of these gives minus 3. So you get another non-trivial check, but again, it's just a numerical check. Okay, now, of course, what we want to do is to compute scattering amplitude. Because we don't know how to get this from gauge fixing, we're going to have to rely on BRST techniques to compute, to describe the amplitude prescription. So we need to know, first of all, BRST operator. So of course, in bosonic string theory, that's just constructed by, you just essentially have the ghosts and the constraints they come from, and that allows you to construct the BST operator. And this formalism, using this description, is just put in by hand. So we have lambda alpha, and it turns out, okay, why am I writing this operator? This operator was first written down by Warren Siegel based on the Green-Schwarz formalism. And it's essentially the space-time supersymmetric version of the fermionic momentum. So P alpha, I should have written down the world sheath actions. Okay, and then there's the right mover. So I'll just concentrate on the left movers here. You can show that space-time supersymmetry acts in the usual way on these variables. So x and theta are like space-time superspace variables. And it leaves lambda invariant. And it turns out this is the unique space-time supersymmetric version of the fermionic momentum. And if you interpret p alpha is like dd theta, when acting on superfields, this just acts in this way. So this I'll call d alpha. So the last term, when acting on a field which only depends on thetas, it doesn't do anything. That's just because there are no poles of theta with theta. So when acting on massive states, it will have a non-trivial effect. Now, as Green and Schwarz show, or as you know, d alpha with d beta satisfies this type of relation. So as in four dimensions, these are the 10-dimensional supersymmetric. They're not the supersymmetry generators. The supersymmetry generators would be this with a minus sign here. So they commute with the space-time supersymmetry generators, and they, but they form this type of algebra. What that means is that Q squared is not automatically zero because d alpha doesn't tend to commute with itself. So what you find is that Q squared is equal to lambda gamma m lambda times the supersymmetric version of dx. So supersymmetric version of dx, I'll write it down here, let's call it pi m, is equal to dxm plus theta gamma. So this is only zero because lambda gamma m lambda is zero. So somehow the pure spinner condition on lambda is crucial for this BRST operator, for this operator to have a BRST interpretation. Okay, no, the constraint is just put in by hand. So I'll say, so when you normally you get constraints by doing a gauge fixing procedure. So as I said, we don't know how to get this lambda coming from gauge fixing some constraint. The reason why we don't know how to do that is because normally if you gauge fix a fermionic symmetry, you get an unconstrained bosonic ghost. I don't know any example where you get the constraint coming from gauge fixing. So I just impose this. It's needed in order, for example, to get the right central charge. And it seems to give a consistent description. And in the end, I will show that it does give a consistent description. But it's not derived from something. Any other questions? Okay, so the simplest thing to do is, for example, is to check that it gives the right physical states. In the massless sector, that's essentially trivial. So in some sense, that was where this formalism was guessed from, is by understanding the structure of the massless states. So vertex operators for open strings should be ghost number one objects. This is open. And if it's ghost number one, it essentially means it's linear in lambda. And as I already mentioned, for the superstring, the massless state is the ground state. So essentially, the massless states only depend on the zero modes of field because it's the ground state. So essentially, this is the only thing you can write down, which is ghost number one. It just depends on the zero modes of x and theta, and this is just some field. And now qv equals zero, and delta v equals q of something. Turns out to imply that A alpha describes superangles, or a supermaxwell, so it's still linearized zero. So what do I mean that when I say that? It means that using this gauge transformation, you can gauge A alpha to the form where it's A slash theta. C. Where AM is the usual gluon and CX is the usual. So these are the gluon and gluino. And dot, 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 because of this constraint, QV equals zero, it implies that dot, dot, dot is just related to derivatives acting on A and C. So one nice feature of this is that the equation of motion satisfied by A alpha is actually linear in derivatives. So remember that D alpha is just linear in derivatives. So QV is just lambda alpha d alpha acting on lambda beta d beta. So if this is going to be zero, it means that the equations of motion just come from a linear operator. Now this is something very unusual. So in bosonic string theory or in most field theories, the equations of motion come from second order operators. If we do this for the closed string, using the fact that supergravity is just, well, that the closed string vertex operator is just the square of the open string vertex operator, you immediately get a similar description for supergravities. In this case, it's ghost number 1, comma 1, left moving and right moving ghost number. So you find V equals lambda alpha. I'll call it lambda hat. If we're doing type 2B, these have the same chirality. And now it depends on both x theta and theta hat. So in this case, you also get a right moving sector. And it turns out that you have Q, of course, is lambda alpha d alpha. Q hat is where d hat is defined in the obvious way by just switching dx with d bar x, etc. And QV equals Q at V equals 0 implies that this describes supergravity. So essentially, you get A alpha beta. Everything is essentially the left-right product. So you get a term times the graviton plus you'll get the Ramond-Ramond field in everything. OK, so this is how the massless states are encoded in the vertex operator. And the massive states are more complicated. I'm not going to go into it, but of course you can also describe the massive states in this language. So we see that it has the nice features that we wanted. The field theory limit is essentially the same as the string theory vertex operators in this formalism. Okay, so now we're going to compute scattering amplitudes. So I have to tell you what the prescription is for computing scattering amplitudes. And the prescription is going to be defined in such a way that the amplitudes will be BRST invariant. So in string theory, unitarity, by unitarity I mean that the factorization gives you, you know, the usual unitarity conditions. I don't mean just positive norm, that's what I'm trying to say. Unitarity is not manifest in string theory. In string theory, except in light cone gauge, the only way to show unitarity is you show that the theory is equivalent to a light cone gauge description. In this formalism, we have BRST invariants. So BRST invariant is essentially going to be used as a substitute for unitarity. So we're going to require that the amplitude prescription is BRST invariant. Okay, so let me remind you in bosonic string theory what the amplitude prescription is. So if you want to do a G-loop computation, what you have to do is you have to integrate over all the different surfaces of G loop, so that essentially 3G minus 3 parameters you need. And then you have to compute some two-dimensional correlation function using this worksheet action. And you have vertex operators. So you have, if you're computing an endpoint genus G scattering amplitude computation, you have to compute the product of let me do for closed strings. You have to compute the correlation function of n vertex operators. But in bosonic string theory, this would not be would give you zero. And the reason is because there are zero modes associated with the BC ghosts. So you have to also include a contribution from the zero modes of the B ghosts. And it turns out there are 3G minus 3 zero modes of the B ghosts, who essentially are each paired with a Teichmuller parameter. So you have an additional integral over the B ghosts. So I'm just going to write it schematically. And essentially the measure you use in the places you put these B ghosts is essentially correlated with the basis you choose for your Teichmuller parameter. So inserting the B ghost just absorbs the zero modes in order to get the non-vanishing prescription. Now this is of course BRST invariant. When you anti-commute Q with the B ghost, you just get the stress tensor, and because it's paired with the Teichmuller parameter, it just gives you a total derivative with respect to the moduli, assuming that the vertex operators are all conformally invariant. So we're going to use the same prescription in this formalism. We're going to just declare this to be the prescription, although we're not going to get it from gauge fixing, as we can do in bosonic string theory. And we're guaranteed that it's BRST invariant in this for the same reason as in bosonic string theory. Okay, now I have to tell you here, what I told you here are what's called the unintegrated vertex operators. So these are the ones which have dimension zero on the worksheet, because obviously they don't have any derivatives. What I want here are the integrated vertex operators. These should have conformal weight 1, 1 in order that this should be conformally invariant. Now the relation between the integrated and the unintegrated is very simple. If you take Q, perhaps I should do open string just to, so I don't have to carry around as many variables. The relation is very simple. It's just Q of the of integrated is equal to the worksheet derivative of the unintegrated. That means that this is going to be conformally invariant because you just get a total derivative. The unintegrated vertex operator we have here. So to determine the V integrated, it's just a cohomology question. You just have to ask what operator, when you hit it with Q, gives you the derivative of this. And you find for the massless state, you just get V is equal it has this form. It's d theta alpha a alpha plus pi m a m. I'll tell you what these superfields are in a second. So these are all superfields. They all depend on x and theta. And they're all constructed out of A alpha by acting with a certain number of derivatives. So AM is a superfield which starts as the gluon. So AM is just equal to gamma M alpha beta D alpha A beta. W alpha is D and I need to and FMN. So this starts out as the gluon, this starts out as the gluino, and this starts out as the field strength of the gluon. Okay, so once we have these vertex operators, we can plug it in here and compute amplitudes, but there's still one missing feature. We need to know what this B ghost is. Okay, so before going into the details, let me say a little bit what we want to do. So, of course, the first thing we want to do is we want to check that this prescription gives the right answer. Okay, so what is the right answer? So for tree amplitudes, of course, we know everything about the amplitudes using RNS. And we can check explicitly. It turns out for tree amplitudes, you don't need any B ghosts. You just need three unintegrated and n minus 3 integrated. So these have been computed and checked that they all agree with the RNS expression. Of course, the advantage using here is that space-time supersymmetry is manifest. So for example, the computations involving external fermions are just as easy to do as the computations of external bosons. The only difficult feature is when you compute this measure factor, you have to integrate over all the thetas. And these are superfields. So you have superfields which appear here. So you have to do the explicit integration over the thetas. It's not so easy to do. Probably the person who has developed the best tools for working with these expressions is Carlos Mafra, who was here until last week. And so he has developed computer programs, for example, that given these vertex operators, he can rapidly compute the amplitude in terms of the gluons and gluinos. So for example, he can easily show, so I think this is now the best way, for example, to compute amplitudes involving external fermions. So another thing he has done, which is essentially based on these techniques, is together with Tsimpas and Steiberger and the last, I think his name is Schlatterer. So what they have done is actually simplified some of these tree amplitude computations in such a way that you can check, for example, these BCJ identities in a way which is much quicker than doing it in components. So of course, this is all automatically in 10-dimensional superspace. Of course, you can dimensionally reduce to 4 dimensions if you like, but you can also just leave it in 10 dimensions. So the advantages of, one of the main advantages that they used is that the vertex operator here, if I compute, for example, 3-point amplitudes, if I just take this OPE, so V1 would be one of these. So let's put this at point Z. And V2 at point zero, then of course you're going to, when you compute the OPE, you'll get a third vertex operator here, which will of course be related to a three-point function involving three super Yang-Mills fields. And it's completely straightforward to read off these three-point functions just using the form of these vertex operators. So essentially it combines the 10-dimensional different component fields into some very compact notation. Okay, so that's three amplitudes. Loop amplitudes, so as I already mentioned, some things have been done using RNS and Green-Schwarz. So for example, 4.1 loop was worked out decades ago by Green and Schwarz. And in RNS, of course, you can also compute it. It's more complicated. You have to sum over spin structures. But for example, it's in Polchinski's book. But for example, 5-point amplitudes. 5.1 loop amplitude is already highly non-trivial in RNS to show that you get some space-time supersymmetric expression. The tricks you use in four-point amplitudes just are not strong enough to do the 5-point. So you can it has been done in Green-Schwarz. I think covariantizing light cone gauge is essentially the way that it's been done. But using this formalism, for example, Mafra, I think he did it with another collaborator, I don't remember. He computed this 5.1 loop amplitude and showed, of course, that it has all the right properties, modular invariance properties, et cetera. Two loop amplitudes. Up to now, it's just been for 4-point. But in principle, you could do higher two loop amplitudes. What's been done up to now is, so for example, one thing you can ask, which is you can check against the duality conjectures, is the coefficients of these one loop and two loop amplitudes, for example, which have to match with the duality conjectures of the type 2B SL2Z duality. And this was, this coefficient of this 4.2 loop amplitude was computed explicitly by Mafra and Roberto Gomez recently and shown that it has the right form. Now, there's an indirect way to compute the normalization of the 4.2 loop amplitude just by using unitarity together with the coefficients of the 3-and-1 loop. But this computation was done directly in the sense that this formalism is not manifestly unitary. So in fact, you can either view this as a check of the duality or you can use it as a check of the unitarity. In RNS, there are no techniques available for computing this normalization directly. Essentially, the only technique that's available is using unitarity. Okay, so these are things that that have been done at one loop and two loop. But what I'm going to talk about now is something related to finiteness conjectures. So once you have the amplitude in this form, you can ask, for example, if there are certain non-renormalization theorems which control the structure of the terms in the effective action. So of course, the SL2Z duality conjecture tells you that there should be some non-renormalization properties. And of course, naive space-time supersymmetry also tells you. So naive space-time supersymmetry, essentially you get zero modes. So the integration over 16 thetas tells you that if your vertex operators don't contain enough thetas, then the amplitude has to vanish. So that's the usual space-time supersymmetry argument that tells you that certain terms are not going to contribute. But in fact, in string theory, you have another ingredient, which you can also do in field theory if you use first quantized language, but that has only recently been developed. I think so Pierre has some work on that, and also there's a Green together with Bjornsson have done some work on extending the results for string theory to field theory. But essentially, for string theory, you have additional zero modes coming from the conjugate momentum to theta. So when we do this integral using string theory, because the formalism has thetas of which are Wilczek scalars and p's which are Wilczek conformal light 1 objects, at loop order g, each of these p's has g zero modes. So there's 16 p's. So that means the zero modes at g loop order, you not only have to absorb 16 thetas, but you have to absorb 16 g of these fermionic p's. And what that means is that at higher and higher loop order, you're going to get more and more non-renormalization terms. Now, this, of course, has been checked by explicit computations by Byrne and Dixon, Kossow, et cetera. But essentially, in the string theory counting, it's essentially just a counting argument. I mean, asking if the amplitude actually vanishes, so suppose it absorbs all the zero modes, You still have to check if the coefficient is zero or non-zero, but suppose just the power counting argument using, or not power counting, but just fermion counting argument gives you something which may automatically be zero without doing a computation. So let me say a little bit about which non-renormalization theorems we can prove using this zero mode count. So that's the last thing I'll discuss. Okay, so we have these vertex operators. We have this B ghost that I haven't told you what it is yet. And together with these vertex operators, the B ghost and the vertex operator has to absorb the zero mode. Okay, so I have to tell you a little bit about the B ghost. So I'm not going to have time to go into much detail, but I will at least give you a sense of how one does the computation. So I should say before I forget, so part of this computation was done together with Michael Green and Pierre Van Hove and Russo, Jorge Russo, and also with Nikita Nekrasov. So the construction of the B ghost is non-trivial. So we want to construct an operator which satisfies Q with B is equal to the stress tensor. The stress tensor is easy to write down. So again, this is a cohomology problem. One wants to find, it's easy to show the Q of this is zero. One wants to construct a B satisfying this. Unfortunately, the solution to this cohomology problem is not so trivial. Essentially, one has to allow operators which depend on inverse powers of lambda. It turns out the answer is something of this form. So I'm not going to, I mean, if there are questions, I can go into detail what I mean by this 1 over lambdas. But let me just leave it at this form for now. So there are essentially four terms. They depend, it's space-time supersymmetric. It only depends on the fermionic variables in this d alpha form. I haven't written down the contractions of the indices. But the important feature that I want to show is that you get a maximum of two d's from this B ghost. Now, there's one other feature of the formalism that I haven't discussed yet, which is that I have to do my functional integration over the thetas and the lambdas. So my measure factor here, when I wrote down this correlation function, has to involve an integration over all the Wolschmidt variables. So I have 10 x's. I have 16 thetas. I have 11 lambdas. And then if you're doing on a higher genus surface, you also have, so this would be for the open string. For the closed string, obviously, you get twice as many here. Now, integrating over these bosonic variables, because they're non-compact variables, will give you infinities. And when that happens, essentially, you have to choose a regulator to regularize these infinities. And the regulator will typically kill as many fermionic zero modes as it kills bosonic zero modes. So the way you introduce the regulator is you insert something which is BRST trivial. Let me call it rho, where e to the q rho, it essentially gives you something which kills an equal number are fermions and bosons. So it will give you something like P I should have written this as theta. So, I mean, I don't have time to go into detail about what this explicit regulator is, but it's not so difficult to construct. So some of these, although it looks like we have an awful lot of zero modes here, some of them are going to be killed by this regulator. You can see that you can kill at most 11g of these fermionic zero modes, because you're essentially 11g of these bosonic zero modes to kill. So to get something non-vanishing, essentially we need to have 5g bosonic fermionic zero modes and 5g of these p's coming at each genus. And they have to come either from the vertex operators or from this b-ghost. Okay. Let me, since I'm already at 3 o'clock, let me give the result. So that doing this counting, one finds out, and using the form of these vertex operators, one finds out what type of terms can be present in the loop amplitudes. So let me give the result, and then if there are questions, we can go into how explicitly how you do the computation. Okay, so if we're doing open string theory and we compute a four-point amplitude, essentially we're going to have something which depends on four powers of the field strength. So if we're just doing gluon scattering, for example. For open string theory, there are two types of terms you can have. You can have a term of this type, or you can have a term of, let me write this here. And then, of course, you can have powers of derivatives acting on here. So let me call it d to the h. And the question is, well, at one loop order, or at tree level, for example, you can show that the amplitude starts its trace after the fourth. Okay, but at higher loop order, because you have to absorb more and more zero modes, you find that at genus G, so let's say 0, 1, 2, so let's go up to 5. One finds that the lowest H, which contributes, keeps rising. So for example, if you compute a genus 2 amplitude, you'll find the trace after the fourth cannot appear, essentially because you can't absorb enough zero modes. The way to see that from this computation here, so given the, the open string, I erased AL. So for example, the field strength appears here at order theta cubed. But you get derivatives of the field strength appearing at order theta fifth, two derivatives appearing at theta seventh. So you see, if you have to absorb more and more thetas, then it's clear you have to add more and more derivatives to f's. Now, it turns out that when you do the higher loop amplitude computation, you have to add more and more thetas essentially to cancel the, well, because of the, it's related to these d's that appear. I don't have time to explain that in more detail. But OK, so what you find is that, let me write the table. So we find trace after the fourth appears here at, of course, at g equals 0, it's fine. So that's h equals 0. H equals 0 here. At h equals 2, you find that you need to have h equals 2, at g equals 2. Whereas the next line has a slightly different structure. This only gets contributions at one loop. So here you have you have a double, you have two traces. So this should be like this. So you need to have at least two boundaries for this term. So at one loop, you can get from non-planar. So this is h equals 0, h equals, sorry, h equals 2. And then finally, let me discuss the r to the fourth for the closed string. Right. Okay, so let's do the, so I have to say a little bit more about where these terms come from. So this was done in collaboration with Van Hoven, Green, and Husso. So the difference between these two structures comes from the following property. When one integrates over the thetas and the p's, one has these four vertex operators. But when you do the computation, there are possible inverse powers of the momentum coming from the fact that when vertex operators collide, you might get a pole which goes like, so this could have a dependence of 1 over z. So it might have a pole coming from the colliding of the two vertex operating. And when you integrate over the length of this moduli, so in order to compute the correlation function, I also need to integrate over these Teichmuller parameters. And the integral over the Teichmuller parameters, if you have this kind of pole dependence, so you integrate over the length, let's call this length L, can give you a factor 1 over, so if this is k1, k2, k. Can give you a factor of 1 over the k squared. Now, in the double trace formula, it turns out just by symmetry properties, you can show, so for this to contribute, obviously you need some, if these are two vectors, you need to get this third massless state coming in here. And it turns out to be, if you switch k1 and k2, you get the minus sign. So for this term here, that doesn't mean the amplitude vanishes, because of course the trace is not invariant if you switch the first and second gluon. So you get two contributions with an opposite sign, but they're different contributions. Here you get two contributions which cancel. So that these inverse powers coming from colliding vertex operators, they reduce here the power of the trace after the fourth, but they don't allow a reduction here. Now, with the r to the fourth, so one also can get d to the h. Now, of course, here you have h equals 0. Now, here you get h equals 4, h equals 6. I skipped one, sorry. H equals 0, h equals 4, h equals 6. H equals 8. And now the question is here, if it keeps on going, so it looks like it's going up by 2 at every interval here. Now, if it kept going forever, if this was equal to 2g, then one can argue just by dimensional analysis and doing reduction to 4 dimensions that n equals 8 supergravity would be finite. Okay. But in this formalism here, at least, one can show that this doesn't keep going forever. And the reason is very simple. It's just because essentially the number of zero modes which you get from this expansion essentially runs out. From the superspace point of view, there's a clear explanation of these numbers here, and it's related to D terms versus F terms. So maybe in the last 5 minutes, I'll say that this type of dependence on H is actually can be understood without doing a string theory computation, but just from naive superspace arguments. So in a string theory, it's still, well, it at this point, we don't have an argument why this needs to be greater than 8, which would mean that at 5 loops, you should start getting a different dependence from the dependence you would need for finiteness of n equals 8 supergravity. It turns out that the 7-loop computation in 4-dimensional supergravity should diverge. So this is, of course, a non-trivial check. If this is vanishing or not, that would be, for me, the first non-trivial check of finiteness of n equals 8 supergravity. So what is the argument related to D terms and F terms? Well, it's a naive argument, but it seems to match the counting here, which is that one expects non-renormalization theorems for F terms and not for D terms. By F terms, I mean an integral over less than the maximum number of thetas. So there is a question of what one means by the maximum number of thetas, because we don't have an off-shell formulation. But at least naively, the maximum number of thetas is just the number of thetas that equal the number of supersymmetries. So in order to write a D term, one essentially has to do this superfield integration. And of course, the missing thing is one has to know what's the superfield here. So this is some function of x theta and theta hat. If you're doing 4-point, this would be, to linearize level, would be something like phi to the fourth. So phi starts out as a scalar. So there's, of course, a scalar in type 2b supergravity, or if you like, n equals 8 equals 4 supergravity. And if the lowest component of phi is the scalar, which carries dimension 0, this object here would carry dimension 8, which is precisely the counting coming from this type of argument. However, it's not obvious from the string theory point of view that you should start with superfields of this type. In fact, in the paper I wrote, it seemed more natural to start with the superfield whose lowest component was Ramond-Ramond field string. In this case, you start with, for example, for type 2b supergravity, you could start, for example, with a 3 form. This has dimension 1. If you start with this as your superfield, then you would find that the counting of the D term only starts at G equals 7 and not G equals 5. Or G equals 9, sorry. Not G equals 5. It's not clear to me, I guess Pierre has done some work on this now, but it's not clear to me exactly what's the right superfield to start. If you start with this superfield, certain symmetries are not so obvious. So, for example, the SL2Z symmetry in 10 dimensions would not be manifest. In 4 dimensions, it would be related to the E7. You start with this, which seems more natural from the string theory point of view, it's not clear that you're getting the lowest the D term of lowest possible dimension. Good. So if we understood off-shell supergravity, we would be not asking not about the linearized level, but the nonlinear. Okay? And then, you're right, we just write the most general. So, for example, n equals 1, d equals 4 supergravity. We know the off-shell formulation. We know the superfield. We just write, we can write, ask if the expression can be written down or not. So, working at linearized level. Okay, so to linearized level, it's not clear that you're writing down the lowest possible term. There might be a term at nonlinear level which reproduces something lower than linear. So, for example, okay, so let's suppose we worked at linearized level. Okay, so we know we have the vertex operators for the superstring. So I wrote it down before. So we had something like gamma m theta. This is not gauge invariant. But, of course, if you go to cubic order in theta, you get the Riemann tensor, which is gauge invariant. So the superfield, the lowest order superfield, actually, in order theta squared, it's also gauge invariant. This is this W I wrote down here. So the field strength, which is gauge invariant in string theory to lowest order, is this W. But in field theory, actually, GMN is, of course, the left-right product of two gluons. There's a dilaton in there. Right? GMN has a trace. That dilaton is gauge invariant. But to linear order in string theory, it's not. Okay, so right, because the way the dilaton appears in string theory is together with the graviton. You can't separate it out in a gauge invariant way. So if you work in field theory, you might try to construct a field strength starting with this phi. Okay? From the string theory point of view, that would not be a natural object. But from the supersymmetry point of view, it's completely spacetime supersymmetric, okay, at least to linearized order. Now, how can this appear in this type of construction? Well, okay, you have to do the computation and you have to see if the zero modes are enough to contribute or not. But from the supersymmetry point of view, it's not clear that string theory gives you the simplest or the lowest dimensional supersymmetric object. So, okay, so I don't know if that answers your question. Okay, I would say from the string theory point of view, this is the natural field strength to use. Okay, it's the left-right product. If you take the left-right product of two open string vertex operators, you'll never get the dilaton. But from the supersymmetry point of view, the dilaton is a perfectly okay superfield. Well, it's not quite, at linearized level. At nonlinear level, there are, for example, SL2Z transformations. This transforms in a complicated way. So if you want to ask it, the amplitude also has these SL2Z symmetries. Phi is not the natural superfield to work with. Okay, somehow SL2Z fixes the phi dependence. You're not allowed to write down an arbitrary function of phi. But from the supersymmetry point of view, okay. So these are things that are not well understood, but yes? No, okay, let me say it again. So here I'm just computing a four-point graviton amplitude, okay? And I'm asking if it could be zero or not using the string theory techniques. It turns out that at H equals 8, it looks like it does not have to vanish, okay? So this is an independent argument. This has nothing to do with the string theory computation. Okay, I've done the string theory computation, I counted zero modes, you find that at H equals 8 is possible. Okay? The computation, let me say why originally I thought it was H equals 12. Okay, the reason why was because...
You don't actually know that thing is not zero.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so there's a subtlety in these zero mode counting arguments which is essentially related to this regulator that I can go into detail, but essentially, the zero-mode counting argument at this point does not rule out this contribution. Okay? So I am suspicious about this, but okay, it's a because of this argument. But this argument was certainly, it's not, I mean, it's just it's an independent way of trying to understand the... Yes? That's right. Then it would go up to 9 loop. And let me say why. So this paper on the open string shed some light on this. So in fact, if you look at the counting for the open string, one can do, of course, a similar type of analysis. So one has the D term. So naively, the D term you would write down is D16 theta. Here, there's no discussion about what's the lowest object. This is W alpha. I mean, there's no dilaton in the game. So the lowest thing you can write down is something like this, which could be traced W to the fourth. This is a linearized analysis. But now, when you go to four dimensions, there's a nonlinear contribution which allows you to write this. So suppose we're down to four dimensions now. What is phi? I forgot already what phi is. Pierre, do you remember what phi was? You just remind me what it is in terms of the there's a nonlinear relation between superfields. When you go, let me say it in a different way. Super Yang Mills, the linearized analysis is just linearized analysis. So there might be some nonlinear definition of the superfields, which gives you something like D to the, I don't remember what the relation is now, I'm sorry. You might get some relation of this type. Okay, it's starting to come back to me. I'm sorry, I don't have it. I don't remember it at the moment. There's a nonlinear relation which relates when you do a supersymmetry variation of a single field, you can get a product of fields. And so although you might think you need to have four powers of the field strength, it turns out because of this nonlinear analysis, you can express it in terms of something involving just two powers of the field strength. And that's another way to write something of lower dimension than you would naively expect. So for example, this thing here, let me do the counting. This has count dimension 8. W alpha, each W alpha has dimension 3/2. So this would have dimension 12. So naively, this would have dimension 20. If I didn't do my counting wrong. 3/2, sorry, it's 3/2, 6. So naively, this would have dimension 14. But if you look at the term which is of lowest of a D term, which is this term here, H equals 2, this has dimension 8, so it has dimension 10 instead of 14. And the way it happened is because of this type of analysis. You get, instead of having 6 of these, you just get 2 of these. And let me determine. So this gives 8. So each of these phis must be just dimension 1. I remember now. Okay, sorry. If you dimensionally reduce 10-dimensional Yang-Mills to 4 dimensions, you get 6 scalars. These are just 2 of the scalars. So these have dimension 1. So the relation is that this expression here is related to an expression with W's, but with instead of having 16 thetas, you just would have, I guess, 8, right? Right. Yeah, okay, it took me a while to remember what I was saying. So these phis are just scalars. So in 10 dimensions, you can't do this, of course. You can't do this in a Lorentz covariant way, because you have to choose 6 of the scalars. Okay. So this would not be a gauge invariant expression in 10 dimensions. But in 4 dimensions, you can write the D term, which involves four gluons. So this is clearly a D term, because it's written as an integration over 16 thetas. But it has lower dimension than the naive D term because it's a nonlinear effect. So something similar could happen here in supergravity. So the naive analysis is not always, based on linearized analysis, does not always work. Okay, so we'll stop there.